Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another APS Portfolio Strategy call. The topic today, Outlook 2022 in MBS and CMBS. I'm Steve Abrahams, Head of Investment Strategy here at Amherst Pierpont. Our outlook for next year came out the weekend before Thanksgiving. A few things have changed, but we were aiming for the beginning for themes that could serve us all well throughout 2022. It covers a wide set of issues that we believe could take the market by surprise, and there's plenty of room for surprise. The pandemic clearly isn't over. The Fed will be tapering and hiking after that, and the economy is in motion. And that's just the macro. There's change underway, of course, in detail in each market. Luckily, we have an excellent team of analysts today that can outline some of the places where opportunity or risk or both are likely to arise next year. We will be joined by Stephen Stanley, our chief economist, Brian Landy, our senior agency MBS analyst, Chris Helwig, our senior non-agency MBS analyst, and Mary Beth Fisher, our senior CMBS analyst. As usual, we're going to try to cover the waterfront over the next 30 to 40 minutes and then open the call to questions from the audience. You should see on the right side of your webinar screen a chat box. You can use that to write and submit questions, and you can do that at any time during the presentation. I'll eventually relay them to the panel. So we will probably turn to audience questions after the initial prepared remarks. So let's go ahead and start with the market macro. And there are a handful of big issues where some of those macro are likely to play out over time. Stay with me. There we go. So I'm just going to focus really on two of these and then refer very briefly to some of the remaining. But probably the most important issue for next year is really a mispriced market for volatility. If you look out at what's ahead of us, there are really two important things that are likely to move the markets in ways that I think are very difficult to predict, and to some degree, we've already seen it in just the 2 weeks since Outlook 2022 hit the press. For one, it's going to be the calibration and recalibration of Fed policy as many things change over the course of the next year. And secondly, the steady handoff of market power from the Fed to private capital. So first of all, a lot has really changed since the Fed tapered, really for the first and only time, and that was happening through most of 2014. And one of the things that changed, of course, has been the Fed itself. At Jackson Hole in 2020, the Fed introduced a new framework for thinking about really the market and its responsibilities, and that was the flexible average inflation targeting regime, where the Fed basically committed to maintaining roughly a 2% inflation target on average. That meant there could be extended periods where inflation would run above target in order to compensate clearly for long stretches of the last 10 years where inflation ran below target, despite the Fed's best efforts to push it up. Now, the interesting thing is that core PCE really exceeded 2% only twice and very briefly between 2008 and 2020. And now, all of a sudden, you look at core PCE and we have been well above 3.5%. So the Fed, its policy tolerance, and its method of operation, its response function has changed. The other thing that's changed has clearly been the economy, partly in the aftermath of pandemic. Clearly that's the case with the labor market, where there are a host of issues still to be resolved coming out of pandemic. But it's also from a restructuring of international trade and supply lines that started before pandemic and has been exacerbated by pandemic as well. And then finally, of course, we have the risk from pandemic. As we, in fact, were discussing on a call earlier this afternoon, the Omicron variant of COVID-19 has just reminded everybody that there is a long tail of variant risk ahead of us, and it remains to be seen how well both the scientific community and the policy community, as well as the economy, is going to manage through that. So that really leaves us ripe for policy recalibration at the Fed, very much like we saw to some degree last week with Fed Chair Powell's testimony before Congress, to some degree really restriking the timeline for taper. And still ahead of us, we have the discussion of how fast and how far the Fed might have to hike. So clearly that's a big potential source of volatility. The Fed is also in the process of handing off to private capital, which has more and often conflicting objectives, and by the way, usually doesn't hold press conferences to say what it's about to do next. The other minor contribution, although maybe not so minor, is going to come from the mortgage market, where we're going to see larger loan balances, which could be a source of delta hedging and volatility as well, and Brian Landy will make a couple of comments on that. So if you look at what history tells us, volatility went up through the Fed's tapering through 2014 and then again in 2015. Of course, for students of the market, they'll be quick to remind that there was a little bit of an energy crash going on at the same time. But of course, it's possible that that energy crash itself reflected some market concern about the economy's ability to tolerate higher rates and tighter policy. Right now, if you look at the vol markets and you look at a forward implied vol, that actually drops. So the market is pricing a decline in volatility rather than an increase, and that just seems like the wrong thing to anticipate. There's a host of different ways that portfolios can position for rising volatility in markets that are really mispriced for it right now. There are trades in the options market, in the mortgage market, and in credit that will leave you well-positioned for rising vol, and even if you take advantage of illiquidity with efforts to preserve as much yield and spread as you possibly can. The second thing I highlight is falling risk-adjusted returns and a flatter spread curve ahead. Risk seems like it's clearly going to go up, at least if we measure it by volatility. But we're still likely to see historical amounts of cash for years to come, even though the Fed is in the first stage of trying to withdraw liquidity. Still, we have taper ahead of us. We have however long it will take for the Fed to hike, and we have renormalization or drawdown of the Fed's SOMA portfolio to what will presumably be still a very high level of reserves in the banking system. That process itself could take 5 to 7 years, even after taper finishes, if history is a guide. And that's not even taking into account large stores of global savings that are out there. If you look at real rates in 5 or 10 years or 30 years, those real rates are still close to historic lows, which reflects expectations for heavy, heavy excess cash, at least relative to demand to borrow over the next decade, if not longer. And if you look at markets, we're already looking at low risk-adjusted spreads. The U.S. Treasury term premiums at this point are negative across the measured maturities. Mortgage OASs prior to the Omicron news were near historic lows. And the spread curve in credit, if you look at high yield versus IG, is also extremely flat. Those are the two probably most important things. The other things that I'd mention include a big lift for credit fundamentals from inflation, which actually suggests historically that the income line of the income statement moves, or the revenue line moves up in inflation far faster than the expense line does, and certainly trailing corporate profit suggests that is strongly the case through pandemic so far. We're looking for very strong markets in private credit, and then there's going to be a handful of niche areas to watch around SOFR, climate, which is really going to have its impact in financial markets, in capital requirements and risk requirements, and some minor issues in crypto that we're looking for as well. So that's kind of a market overview. Turning to the economy, Stephen Stanley has been noticing things that are likely to surprise as well and can go through those. Stephen.
Thanks, Steve, and good afternoon, everyone. Yeah, so there are a couple of themes, I think, that dominated in 2021. And, you know, I think the carryover from that into 2022 will be very interesting. One is that we had this persistence and ubiquity of supply bottlenecks in 2021. And I think the consensus view heading into 2022 is that those are going to abate and that they will be mostly dissipated by, say, the middle of next year. And, of course, the Fed has been working under the whole transitory hypothesis with regard to inflation, pretty much under that assumption, and has gradually been walking that back and recognizing that that the duration of what they've been calling transitory was going to be longer and longer than they had initially suspected. But my thinking here is that not all bottlenecks in the economy right now are purely a function of pandemic caused supply issues. I think on top of the constraints that we're seeing on the supply side, we're also seeing extraordinarily strong demand, and that is also playing a role, and that is not likely to go away soon. So let me give an example of one of each of those. I would take the auto sector as an example of a pure supply constraint, where we had, for a variety of reasons, we had shortages of chips that plagued automakers throughout the latter part of 2020 and all through 2021. And so auto production has suffered all through this year, and it's starting finally to pick up a little bit, but it won't get back to normal until well into 2022. That's purely a supply issue. Now, once we get back to full production levels, we'll have to see just how robust demand is, and it's possible that demand would still outstrip an even, you know, a fully restored production capacity. But for now, we'll call that a pure supply constraint. On the other hand, I would argue that the backups that we've seen at West Coast ports that you've all read about extensively, while there are some supply-driven issues there, is mostly a demand function. It's a result of an unprecedented demand for goods coming from consumers, given the extraordinarily strong position of household balance sheets. We've seen, you know, these all the talk about the ships being backed up in the ocean, and we've got shortages of drivers and all the rest. The reality is that at the end of the day, what's driving all of this is that demand is just so strong that it's outstripped what would even be a normal capacity. It was interesting. We had the head of the ports of Long Beach in Los Angeles was on CNBC this morning, and he was making exactly that argument. He was saying that, hey, things are getting better, but at the end of the day, you know, we're just struggling because people, you know, the flow of goods that are coming through our ports is just so much higher than what we've ever seen before. So I think what we're going to see as we move into 2022, consumer demand should remain very strong. We know that households are sitting on trillions of dollars of excess liquidity that they accumulated over the course of the pandemic. Businesses are in very good condition fiscally and prepared to spend. And I think what we're going to find as the economy on the supply side gets more and more back to normal is that even once we have a more or less normalized supply capacity in the economy, that we're going to still see the economy running hot because demand is so strong. The second thing I would point to is really very much analogous with regard to the labor market. We've had a labor shortage this year. There's been a lot of talk over the course of the year that things would ease up in the fall with the end of supplemental unemployment benefits, with kids going back to school and thus freeing up parents to get back into the workforce, and with health concerns starting to ease to some degree as more people get vaccinated. There was a presumption that more people would join the labor force and that that would help to ease the intense supply shortage of workers that we've seen over the course of 2021. Unfortunately, it hasn't been quite that clean. We did see a big increase in labor force participation in November. It was the first really big number that we've seen in a while, and that is certainly welcome. And I would say, you know, anecdotally and surveys of businesses and whatnot all suggest that businesses are having a little more success finding workers. So I do think we're starting to see, you know, a little bit of a thaw on the supply side of the labor market. But my sense is that even if we get back to, you know, normal labor force participation, and there's going to be a lot of debate, of course, about what that is, that we're still going to look at, at an economy where there's more demand for labor than there are available workers. You know, we've all seen the JOLTS numbers on job openings and just any number of indicators from surveys of businesses and you know, gathering of anecdotal reports and whatnot suggesting that businesses are intensely trying to staff up and just have been frustrated at every turn in trying to find enough workers. And I think even if we do see a few million extra people jump back into the labor force, we're going to get to something approximating full employment, in my view, early next year, probably certainly by the spring, you know, maybe by the end of the first quarter. And at that point, I would say demand is still going to be very strong, and we're going to continue to see a hot labor market with all the things intended that that come with that, including rising wage growth. On the inflation front, I think, you know, certainly that was the biggest surprise in 2021. People did not come into the year thinking inflation was going to accelerate, or if it would, not for very long. And in fact, it's really galloped higher to levels that I don't think anyone could have imagined even just a few months ago. The Fed is quite confident that it will come down in 2022, although they've been a little less optimistic about the pace of that and the timing. And I do think that inflation will come down, but I'm not nearly as optimistic as the Fed is. I would just point you back to the latest set of FOMC minutes, which showed that the Fed board staff, even, you know, as late as this fall, felt like we were going to get right back to 2% by the end of 2022 on core inflation, and that it would remain there in 2023 and 2024. I do think that we're going to see inflation decelerate by the end of 2022, but I think it's going to be running still well above the Fed's target, and certainly throughout the year, the Fed's going to be playing catch-up. And that leads me to the last theme that I wanted to explore, which is we've seen huge movement in what the market is assuming about the near-term monetary policy outlook. So if you go back to early 2021, the consensus was that the Fed wouldn't be lifting off until maybe 2024, that it was going to be years. That has obviously changed. The market is pricing significant tightening for next year. But the one thing that hasn't changed, at least not yet, is that market participants still are pricing in historically low endpoint for the upcoming tightening cycle. So if you look at futures, really for the most part, investors are expecting that Fed policy rates will never get to 2% in this cycle. And even though the Fed itself believes that the long-run neutral rate is 2.5, and, you know, presumably if you're trying to tamp down inflation, you would want to move beyond that into restrictive territory to do so. So I would suspect that if the economy continues to run strong, and in particular if inflation is still running above target, even after the Fed begins to raise rates, that there is a decent chance that by the second half of 2022, at least some market participants are beginning to question whether we're going to have such a low terminal rate for this cycle. That is the one element of monetary policy for which there really has been no change at all in the outlook within, you know, the context of what is priced into the market. And so maybe the last shoe to drop once the tightening cycle actually does begin next year. With that, I'll send it back to Steve.
All right. Thanks so much, Stephen. So the Fed policy, the economy, isn't the only place where we're looking at some historic changes. That also includes the agency MBS market. and that should play, some historic change there should play a pretty significant role, along with a few other themes that Brian Landy has been looking at as well. Brian?
Good afternoon. Thanks for calling in. In my mind, the broad theme for agency MBS next year is bigger. Higher loan limits should allow the agencies to capture a larger share of origination. TBA loan sizes will increase. Private investors will buy a bigger share of agency production as the Fed tapers. Regulators favor a larger role for government-sponsored lending, whether through the GSEs, FHA, or other government agencies. And originators will feel the pressure to consolidate as primary-secondary spreads have fallen and the profits of the pandemic refi wave are behind us. But this growth is going to add negative convexity to the market. Starting with loan limits, the historic home price appreciation of the past year pushed loan limits up 18% over 2020 levels, or 2021 levels. A large share of loans in prime jumbo 2.0 deals now qualify for agency execution, whether conforming or jumbo conforming. There are even more loans that qualify now sitting on bank balance sheets. Agency MBS should grow at the expense of private securities and bank portfolios, although how fast that happens depends on mortgage rates. The larger loans will increase the negative convexity of the TBA contract, and since the Fed is tapering, many of those pools will end up owned by private investors and not the Fed. So one idea would be to position relatively recent production pools. For example, 2019 and 2020 non-specified pools should have much lower loan sizes than the 2022 production that will come to dominate TBA delivery. Over time, higher loan limits should push TBA prices down, and that will show up in higher payups across specified pool categories and for seasoned pools that maybe don't currently command a payup today. And pools should look more attractive since persistent roll specialness is likely to fade as the Fed tapers. So another reason to expect a bigger role for agency MBS in the housing market is that the current administration, various government agencies, generally favor policies that expand the reach of government-sponsored lending. A larger footprint enhances policymakers' ability to sponsor affordable housing initiatives and boost home ownership rates. There will be a focus on first-time buyers in underserved communities. For example, there's a congressional proposal to subsidize loans that would be available only to certain first-time buyers. And the FHA discussed initiatives such as providing down payment assistance in the recent annual report to Congress. Of course, investors will continue to worry that pricing changes, whether loan-level pricing adjustments and G fees at the GSEs or insurance premiums at the FHA, could lower mortgage costs and increase refinancings. And policymakers likely do want to lower fees, but that decision is complicated. Regulators must balance lower fees and insurance premiums against the financial health of the GSEs and FHA, and they take that seriously. The FHA already passed on an opportunity to lower insurance premiums alongside the annual report, which suggests that any cuts are at least a few months away. And there's a lot of uncertainty around how the large number of delinquencies and recent cures will perform in the future path of home prices that weigh on the health of the insurance fund. The FHA does not want to cut premiums too much or too early and put the fund at risk. And it doesn't help borrowers if the FHA later must reverse course and raise premiums. And similarly, a targeted approach is more likely to prevail at the GSEs, where broadly lowering guarantee fees and LLPAs may be less attractive than using fees from higher credit borrowers to finance programs for low-income and first-time borrowers. Finally, tighter primary-secondary spreads and lower profits should push consolidation among originators. Larger, more efficient lenders may see opportunities in buying smaller lenders that aren't as aggressive about contacting their customers about refinance opportunities. So keep an eye on acquisitions and MSR trades that could shift loans from a slower lender to a faster lender. And thank you, and with that, I'll hand it back to Steve.
All right. Thanks very much, Brian. So the interplay between the agency and the non-agency market, which has been fascinating to watch through the course of the pandemic, looks like it's also, again, going to be a major theme. And Chris Helwig has been watching that and thinking about what it means, that and other things, and what they mean for the non-agency MBS market next year. Chris?
Hey, thanks, Steve. Good afternoon, everybody. The PLS market definitely seems to be at somewhat of an inflection point going into next year. Obviously, as my colleagues have already mentioned, the specter of higher interest rates looks to reduce refinancing activity. The increased reach of the GSEs in both higher balance and investor products should redirect loans that were marked for PLS execution this year into GSE channels next year. The combination of these factors, along with near historically tight levels of mortgage credit availability, should shift the focus of lenders and subsequently private label supply into a more expanded credit lending next year. I think we have somewhat of an existing natural experiment showing the impact of higher rates on private label issuance. You know, I don't think we're ever going to get to levels that we saw in 2003 and 2004, but obviously under the Greenspan Fed in the early 2000s, the Fed slashed target interest rates by 500 basis points between 2001, 2003, and then begun to hike in the summer of 2004. Obviously, the precipitous decline in rates led to, you know, what was then an unprecedented wave of refinancing activity that subsequently dried up as the Fed began to raise rates. And as rates rose, the contribution of prime loans to private label issuance dipped, while expanded credit lending increased fairly substantially. Now, that's not in any way trying to suggest that 2004 is a perfect corollary to the current market environment, but I think we definitely see some fairly striking similarities as I kind of dug in on you know, my theory here. The two-year rate of home price appreciation between 2003 and 2004 is nearly identical to the amount of home price appreciation we've seen in the past 2 years. From the beginning of 2003 to the end of 2004, home prices rose by roughly 28%, almost lockstep with what we've seen over the last 2 years. Higher home valuations should have, to Brian's point, a more meaningful impact on the current private label market, as, you know, these agency loan balances certainly look to encroach on loans that otherwise would have been earmarked for private label execution. One other thing that I thought was really interesting is the growth in the expanded credit market in 2004 was preceded by a fairly significant overall tightening in mortgage credit availability in the run-up to that. Using a couple metrics, including the Fed Senior Loan Officer Survey, you saw banks tightening credit availability in 2002 and 2003. Using those same metrics, we've obviously seen banks tighten credit in the wake of the pandemic, you know, kind of looking at the MBA's mortgage credit availability index reflects a lot of the same themes. So it certainly seems like the bounce in expanded credit lending in 2004 was preceded by an overall precipitous tightening, albeit for, you know, different reasons in this experience. You know, recent non-QM issuance suggests there's probably two real areas of growth next year. First, loans to self-employed borrowers and loans to investors looking to use properties' rental income rather than their own to secure financing. Looking at kind of the last, you know, 6 to 9 months of non-QM issuance shows that anywhere from 30 to upwards of 90% of collateral backing non-QM trusts are loans to self-employed borrowers, something that we think it looks likely to continue, given that overall demographic trends seem to support increased opportunity in loans to self-employed borrowers. The amount of self-employed borrowers in the workforce has really risen fairly steadily from 2001 until the beginning of last year, when the pandemic really reduced the amount of self-employed workforce. Subsequent, we've seen a real rebound in self-employed borrowers. You know, some of this seems to be a fairly secular demographic trend where people are obviously getting alternative sources of income, whether you're a YouTuber or something else. But it certainly feels like we're, you know, there's somewhat of a secular shift away from traditional W-2 based income that, you know, could really help drive non-QM issuance volumes. You know, touching on another point that Brian made, you know, there's likely substantial incentives for originators to shift resources into expanded credit lending. a likely larger agency footprint may not be sufficient to offset potential declines in refinancing activity and lower gain on sale margin in agency product as rates rise. There's also already some evidence of increased focus on expanded credit from large agency originators. Expanded credit lending rose by roughly 24% in the third quarter of this year. The largest increase was noted from Guaranteed Rate, who led all non-QM or expanded credit lenders in the quarter. Additionally, non-QM issuance in November was kind of lockstep with Prime Jumbo, with agency eligible falling, you know, fairly reasonably behind that this month. You know, I would think that large publicly traded mortgage originators will likely view expanded credit lending as a revenue stream that can help offset cyclical revenue associated with a reliance on agency refinancing activity as they look to smooth earnings across multiple rate cycles. But in all likelihood, the growth in the expanded credit market will likely be driven by the level and duration of higher interest rates. Higher nominal rates for longer periods of time should drive increased investments by originators to expand manual underwriting capacity. I think shifting away from kind of expanded credit, the other big source of supply for the private label market next year will likely come from the GSEs. You know, gauging the amount of CRT supply that could hit the market next year is always a bit of a challenging exercise as it relies on a few factors. Obviously, the biggest one is the amount of qualifying gross production that the enterprises will purchase next year. You know, based on internal estimates of 1.5 to 1.75 trillion, that could translate to roughly 45 to 50 billion in new CRT next year, assuming a 3% slice of risk. In addition to organic growth supply, additional supply may come in the form of issuance, referencing Fannie Mae's retained guarantee book of loans acquired during their pause in issuance. Their issuance will be earmarked just for 2021 production, and you know, it's hard to say how much of their retained guaranteed book is 2021 versus earlier production, but assuming you know, roughly 500 billion of the roughly 1.1 trillion that Fannie has on its books where they haven't transferred credit risk could add another 7.5 to 10 billion of net supply. I think in terms of demand meeting supply, obviously, as forbearance plans come to their terminus this year, there will be more cash flow coming back to CRT investors. Looking at 2019 performance against the backdrop of low delinquencies and higher interest rates, annual paydowns totaled just about $11 billion. On $58.2 billion of average outstanding volume. Comparable paydowns would offset about 18% of gross issuance next year, assuming those proceeds were reinvested in CRT. So that would equate to roughly $32 to $38 billion of net issuance, with an additional $7 to $10 billion adjusted for incremental catch-up from Fannie Mae. So that brings you to kind of a net supply of $43 to $49 billion of CRT next year. I think in terms of the implications for spreads there, obviously, you know, open window cash flows, there may be more cash, available for, mezzanine bonds, and, they should meet with reasonable demand, although placing larger deep subordinate classes may continue to be challenging, given the relative finite investor base there and limited amount of pay downs, potentially to be repatriated into newer deals. So kind of in conclusion, I think the private label market next year likely will reflect certain pre-crisis trends. Expanded credit looks to grow. The big change is that the GSEs will be sellers of mortgage credit risk rather than buyers of it. And I'll leave it there.
All right. Thanks very much, Chris. And let's now turn to CMBS and commercial real estate. And Mary Beth Fisher is looking into next year and finding some interesting things to do. Mary Beth?
Thanks, Steve. Hey, everybody. Thanks for hanging out this late in the afternoon. CMBS is kind of a story of what's going on in the various sectors, and obviously the outperforming sector for more than a decade has been multifamily. Multifamily property price appreciation has outpaced that of all other commercial real estate sectors. It's averaged 7 to 8% per year until the pandemic hit, and when the pandemic hit, it's kind of followed single-family price appreciation and increased about 18% year-over-year over the last year. This has helped put multifamily rent growth, and single-family rent growth, single-family rental rent growth, on track to have 17 to 18% rent growth for new leases year-over-year. So the fundamentals for that sector remain strong over the long term. The downside is that continued rent growth is, we expect property prices, they've already shown a little bit of a tendency over the last 2 months to begin to plateau. Rent growth has shown a little bit of a tendency on the single family side to start plateauing. We expect that to continue into 2022. Not expecting any sort of a slide, not as aggressive as some other analysts on the street who are looking at another year of 20% growth in single-family or multifamily property prices. Oh, and I'm only speaking for multifamily, not for Brian on the single-family side. And one of the reasons is incomes have increased, but trying to get, there's no way to finance your rent the way there's a way to finance your home over a long period of time. So incomes going up 6% doesn't really help you offset rent growth going up 20%. So we expect that, simply from the consumer side to keep that a little bit down and to put some downward pressure on the continued growth in multifamily property prices and rent growth. So kind of would like to stay positively constructive in the long term, but probably neutral on the sector in the short term for multifamily. One of the other things that's going on in multifamily, and this isn't a huge wave like the last housing crisis, but buyouts of multifamily loans that have defaulted during the pandemic or are currently delinquent and in special servicing is going to peak probably next year, likely in the second or the third quarters. The best place to analyze that is in the Freddie Mac Small Balance Loan Program, because that's clearly the focus of that program. So far, they've had, after having very, very few, literally four loans default prior to the pandemic, they've had 64 defaults and resolutions during the pandemic, and they have about another 150 loans that are already in delinquency and in special servicing that should probably go through workout next year. So those will generate some involuntary prepayments for FRESB agency investors, and it'll create some credit losses for the BP's investors who are not wrapped by the agency guarantee. But again, what happened during the housing crisis, that will produce likely, if you look at a 33% loss severity, about 70 basis points of losses for the FRESB portfolio overall, which is not high, and certainly well within tolerance for Freddie and all the GSEs to manage. And we expect to see a little bit of that also in Ginnie Mae and Fannie Mae DUS. So that's going to happen next year. So where should investors look if they want to get some outperformance next year? And it's always a little risky because you have to go into the stuff that's a little bit riskier to want to overweight it, and that is going to be in office and lodging sectors in commercial real estate. If you look at any of the big price indexes from Green Street or from CoStar, sort of the all-property price index from Green Street increased 24%. Year-over-year as of this month, and that's up 14%, the all-property price index, since the pandemic started. Now, the only two sectors that haven't done that are actually office properties and lodging, where office remains 4% below pandemic property prices, and lodging is still 1% below. The best bargains in those two areas are actually in the subsectors, where we would recommend an overweight. And the subsector for lodging is really in business travel lodging, which has lagged the rest of lodging. People have still traveled. People have leisure traveled, gone on vacation. So properties that specialize in leisure travel have actually continued to do somewhat better to a lot better than business travel hotels. You know, the big convention centers, the big business travel hotels in New York, in Las Vegas, in Houston, certainly in San Francisco, those are the ones that are still struggling to come up. So we would actually look at lodging, talk to our traders, talk to them because they have very good calls into what hotels are going to do, are expected to do well. But that's where you could probably bargain hunt a little bit in conduit CMBS and single asset, single borrower deals. On the office side, urban core offices have done more poorly than suburban offices, but our recommendation would be that it's probably a little bit safer bet to look at suburban offices because as corporations continue to fan out their footprint, they feel more comfortable going into suburban office space and being less dense in the core urban office areas, like New York, like San Francisco. And so that's kind of a, we expect that the office space to recover more in the suburbs before it does in the urban cores. And it's kind of a, it's still, as everyone knows, and we're all sitting here, some in the office and some from home, and the jury's a little bit still out to how much dense the urban cores are going to get. According to the latest transit data, there's only about 40% of the security badges that are being scanned on any given day in New York. So office occupancy for Manhattan is still at about 40% of what it was prior to the pandemic. How long it'll take for that to come back, if it ever completely comes back in the way that it is right now, is still unclear. So happy to be bullish on that. Probably not doing it right away until we get a few more months into away from Omicron. But we do like, again, office in the suburbs and lodging, business travel hotels look like great places to go for outperformance. In the single family rental sector, they've actually had prices driven up by, you know, just like multifamily housing, property price appreciation has gone up, single family property price appreciation has gone up, and the rents in the single family sector have gone up as well. Still positive on that sector, but the best place to probably look for investment opportunities is in the build for rent sector in SFR. Those are not in securitized deals because securitized deals only do stabilized single family rental properties. So if you want to look at private financing for build for rent opportunities, that's really where what's attracting the bulk of the equity capital right now and where the bulk of the opportunities are for outperformance. And that is it for me, and I'll pass it back to Steve.
All right. Fabulous, Mary Beth. So I just remind listeners that you can ask questions of the panelists today. If you look on your webinar screen, on the right side, there's a question chat box. You can use that to send a question, and I'll relay it to the best panelist, although everybody, of course, is free to jump in. Okay, so we're getting a question, which I think sounds like a Stephen Stanley question. So, Stephen, in the last point that you made in your outlook, you suggested that it could end up that the Fed is a little bit behind the curve. And I think many in the market are empathizing with the questioner here. Can the Fed actually catch up with where it should be and produce a smooth landing, or are we at risk of recession once the Fed finds itself behind on policy?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you know, I haven't priced in a disruptive scenario at this point. So if you look at how the Fed raised rates in the last cycle, and that seems to be, you know, going back to my original comments, the market seemed to be taking a lot of their cues from that. The Fed basically moved every other meeting, you know, once a quarter, basically by 25 basis points, which kind of caps you out at 100 basis points per year. The Fed does still believe that the neutral rate is low, as I mentioned, around 2.5. So I don't think they want to get in too much of a hurry because they simply don't think they have very far to go. But you can certainly come up with scenarios where the Fed ends up going either sooner or at a more rapid clip. on their rate hikes than what is being priced in. I don't have that. I mean, I'm assuming basically every other meeting for several years, almost as far as the eye can see, just to get back to neutral or maybe a little above it. But yes, I think there's a definite risk if inflation continues to accelerate that they would find themselves really behind the eight ball and need to raise rates in a way that could be disruptive. I mean, I guess the most recent example of something along those lines would be 1994 when the Fed raised rates from 3 all the way to 6 in a 12-month period. You know, so 300 basis points in 1 year is a lot different than 25 every other meeting. So there are a lot of scenarios, and most of the more dire ones are ones that I haven't really actively contemplated just yet. But, you know, we'll have to see how inflation evolves over the next couple of quarters.
Okay, thank you. It looks like we've got a nice diverse audience here. So this question is coming in on CMBS. And the listener is asking about Ginnie Mae project loans. Obviously, there was lots of developments there, especially in 2020 with fast prepayment speeds. We've had at least some time to think about that, but I guess the broad question is, are there opportunities there? So that's for Mary Beth Fisher.
Great. Thanks, Steve. Yes, there's a lot of opportunities in Ginnie Mae project loans, and they have had we did look at I'll start with prepayment speeds because we expected them to drop off a little bit more than they did over the last couple of months. And the last few weeks, they've accelerated again as we've had yet another downdraft in rates. So there's going to continue to be heavy deal print probably through December, through January, and possibly into February, depending on what the path of rates is there. Because prepayment speeds have been very high. They've been particularly high for the 2018 vintage because the 2018 vintage was the last vintage that had these sort of very high 4%-ish coupons on the loans. So those speeds have been very high, and those loans also have really high prepayment penalties still attached, which is the prepayment penalties go to the IO holders. So that's been an outstanding development for them because they've had 10%, 9%, 8% prepayment penalties delivered to the IO holders. And as long as those prepayment speeds stay fast, those IO holders are going to have all the penalties accrued to them. Now, what's going to happen, hopefully, if the Fed does raise rates next year, is you're going to get a dramatic slowdown in prepayment speeds. And then you have the other situation where the IO holders do really well is when the penalties drop off, but the extension of duration is very, very long. So Ginnie Mae project loan IOs do really well when prepayment speeds are very, very fast or very, very low for a long time. Kind of in the middle is where their performance is not as impressive, but hopefully we're going to go from one scenario to the other. The other good thing about Ginnie Mae project loans is they allow people to do renovation and not from the ground up construction, but significant renovation projects. And those are really good for investors because you get a little bit more coupon, you get a little bit more, a longer lockout period because they're always locked out during the construction phase, and you get a little bit more stability at least for the first, you know, 6 months to a year and a half, depending on how long the construction phase lasts. So those opportunities in Ginnie Mae project loans we think look excellent going forward. Again, it's kind of the going from what has been fast prepayment speeds, which are probably going to persist for a few months, and as soon as the Fed starts raising rates, those speeds should drop off very, very much, and then you're going to have a kind of a massive extension. Both of those are favorable.
Okay, super. Thank you very much. So a question that looks like it's for Chris Helwig. So, Chris, you were talking a little bit about the return, or at least the expansion of expanded lending next year. I guess if you roll back in the history books to the late 90s or early 2000s, Alt-A and subprime lending were a significant share of the market. considerably lower now. Are we heading back to that incidence of expanding lending?
Well, I mean, broadly, I would say no. I'm going to date myself by calling what was the late 90s and early 2000s B and C lending, which translates to roughly to Alt-A and subprime lending in the early to mid-2000s. I think one generally underappreciated factor is when you look at historical share of gross issuance that kind of B and C lending or Alt-A and subprime lending effectively made up in that period, you were really talking, which ranged from about 8 to 12% of gross originations. Obviously, you had a subprime, fairly robust and then kind of overheated subprime market. You know, I don't think, especially kind of given the strength of the MMIF, and which is kind of hovering around 8% right now, obviously there's no, to Brian's point, preemptive move to lower MIF, but it certainly feels like FHA has supplanted the private market as kind of the subprime lender. So I don't think we can really retrace back to those levels. But, you know, we're at such low levels of expanded credit right now, even if we were to float back up to kind of a mid-single digits type Alt-A market, which represented, you know, 4 to 5% of gross originations in a year, I think that would certainly lead to substantially greater supply of expanded credit.
Okay, this looks like actually, Chris, a follow-on for you on investor loans, and in particular, some of the thinking around investor loans that are really underwritten to the rental income rather than some of the traditional borrower's attributes. I guess that's kind of a crossover between investor, multifamily, and other things. What do you see as the prospects for that?
I mean, I certainly think given how robust home price appreciation has been over the last year, it's going to be a lot more challenging for investors to qualify for loans based solely on their income. So I think we are certainly in a position where more borrowers will be reaching to underwrite those loans using the property's rental income rather than their own personal income. I think obviously as we kind of stepped into the pandemic, DSCR loans in residential mortgage transactions were completely untested, right? We had never seen those loans before in pre-crisis transactions. Now, performance of those loans has been, you know, fairly pristine. They're actually delinquency rates on DSCR loans are generally lower than most other non-QM cohorts. I think that's largely attributable to the fact that these loans were underwritten using very strong compensating credit characteristics. The other thing I think you kind of need to be mindful of when you're talking about the DSCR product and how attractive it should be for originators is the fact that since these are not consumer loans but business purpose loans, they are allowed to carry hard prepayment penalties. And I think if you kind of look at how risk retention has changed across sponsors of non-QM, it has become much more of an IO cash flow than a PO cash flow, where you see sponsors of securitizations able to satisfy risk retention just by holding excess IO. So I think to the extent that sponsors of deals are going to be much more prepay sensitive, as most of their risk retention will be tied up in prepay sensitive cash flows. At least in my estimation, I think that certainly is a fairly strong tailwind for an increase in DSCR as a percentage of expanded credit.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. And a question for Brian Landy. So, Brian, you mentioned the likelihood of servicer consolidation next year. And as we've seen many times in the agency market, servicer can have a pretty significant impact on prepayment behavior. Is there any way to anticipate what this consolidation may do for speeds, making them faster, slower, or otherwise?
Sure. Yeah, I think I would be much more concerned about faster speeds, or at least faster refinancing. I think that the opportunity would be much more for a faster, more aggressive lender to look at a portfolio from somebody that isn't operating in that same fashion and say, okay, there's a lot of untapped potential in this set of loans, and whether acquiring the through a merger or just an MSR acquisition, getting access to those loans and being able to tap them for potential refis and other opportunities. So my leaning is to think more about faster speeds and kind of be on the lookout for that.
Okay, and I'm going to actually follow with a question of my own, because I know we've talked about what the year looks like ahead for Ginnie Mae and conventional, especially as it regards regulatory or policy risk. What are your thoughts on that? Does one side of the balance hold more risk than the other?
Yeah, I think in general, I'd say probably favor conventional. I mean, although I think like I talked earlier, the
conventional has more risk.
Oh, sorry, conventional has less risk, I think, than Ginnie Mae. I think that I said earlier that the FHA will move very cautiously in terms of NIP cuts and other things. I mean, certainly the risk is still there, and I think not everybody maybe will believe me on that. So there's certainly I think a diversity of opinions about what what the future might hold there, and I think that that's probably a big factor in terms of kind of where I'd say you probably lean more towards conventional over Ginnie. But I think it's also you've got the workout of loans that went through forbearance and whether they've already cured or are waiting to cure and what happens. I mean, there's I think just more uncertainty around that as well.
Okay, fabulous. So I think we are coming up on the hour, which makes us, I suppose, officially out of time today. I want to thank all of our panelists, Stephen Stanley, Brian Landy, Chris Helwig, Mary Beth Fisher. I would encourage listeners to go back and dig up out of your email the Outlook material that was sent the weekend before Thanksgiving, or go to the APS Portfolio Strategy website, which makes all of that available either based on date or based on the analyst. So a great, great resource if you're sitting around trying to figure out how you want to position next year. We should have a recording of this call available in the next day or so, so keep on the lookout for that. I'm Steve Abrahams. As usual, thanks for listening today or any day that you dial into an APS Portfolio Strategy call. Keep an eye on your email box for all of the APS strategy coming your way. Again, thank you, and have a great afternoon.